The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
People today would look at gold and say, why would I allocate to gold when there's only upside in the market? You, my friend, if that is your mindset, you have been manipulated. You are controlled, and your actions are contributing to the distortion in asset prices, where gold may be lower than it could have been or ultimately will be, and stocks are higher than they can stay forever.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Well, this is week two of our question and answer program, Dave. I always love these shows, like I said last week, and you were talking about curiosity. Curiosity and deliberate life. And I've told you in the past, I've always enjoyed watching and being around your family, because not only are they curious, you're a very curious guy, but they're very deliberate in looking forward and making legacy type decisions.
One of the things I love about doing these programs at the end of the year, and I hope this sets the tone for next year as well. Number one, it's very clear that we don't have all the answers to all the questions. And number two, there's more questions that haven't been asked yet that are very, very important.
Sometimes the question is more important than the answer.
And so when we go into 2020, I think one of the things we have to bear in mind is that everyone who's thinking, should I ask this question? Or is it worth asking? It absolutely is. That's the nature of curiosity and exploration. Don't invalidate what is on your mind in terms of a question. Ask it and then pursue the answer.
Yeah. And reading and asking outside of your field of expertise, that's important as well. So let's get started with the second program. This next question is from Alfred. Hi, guys. Always enjoy your podcast and appreciate the financial education. Thanks in advance for indulging me here. I'll try to be concise. And then he puts his concise question, which is very short.
2 pages?
Well, no. The first one is very concise.
Okay.
So he says, how will this ultimately play out? Okay, so do you have hours and hours? Or why don't we go to the real question? This is the next one. It's a little longer, but I think he's being a little bit more specific. The real question is, certainly, in agreement that long-term, maybe not so long-term, hard assets and precious metals and related stocks will be the preferred, if not the only place of refuge. That being said, we are truly in unprecedented times with negative interest rates, which is in essence a default prior to issue, albeit most people who have been part of defaults would be ecstatic with 98% capital retention, half of the corporate debt being triple B, et cetera, et cetera. But in a world where printing money is unrestricted and the people have enough confidence in the currency, as crazy as that may seem, maybe they can really keep the faith. So what I'm wondering is, how much thought do you give to this merely continuing on as it merely has, more specifically, slower and slower growth, more money printing, pockets of the marketplace collapsing? I mean, what? That's his question.
Well, let me go back to the first thing. How will this ultimately play out? I'm going to tell you how it's going to play out for me.
Okay.
I'm going to enjoy my family.
Right.
I am going to read lots. I'm going to exercise and stay healthy. I'm going to invest in relationships. I'm going to balance a portfolio for multiple outcomes. I mean, how this all plays out, we get to enjoy each day and sort of the immediate future according to the choices that we make.
Well, so, and spiritual health. I mean, that's part of the legacy as well. I mean, that what's eternal?
But how does this play out in terms of what are the final outcomes? I totally get the point of the question, which is, you know, are we veering towards an Armageddon crash, or does this stretch itself out over such a prolonged period of time that really nothing changes except for these little pockets of implosion? And, you know, that's where, you know, over a long period of time, you see the devaluation of a currency, and it's sort of buying some sort of economic and financial market stability, while at the same time basically being the long-term saga of the murder of a currency, the death of a currency. And, you know, can that occur? Can that happen? I think that is, to some degree, what's happening. Do you ultimately have that Armageddon-type crash? Well, it's possible, too. Contagion is a real factor if you look at the math of catastrophism, when it happens, it goes, and it mm-hmm. just goes, because now you're talking about a collapse, and a collapse in confidence is something that is, as we've often said, it's a sociological event, it's a psychological event, it's not just an economic or monetary event. So when people think about inflationism or inflation of asset prices, they tend to think in terms of the math behind it, but there is a psychology behind it, and there is a sociology as well, and these are bigger factors which leave open that possibility of a ridiculously horrendous crash. But we do have a slow-moving train wreck already, and that is what we have. I think one of the things that we've tried to do on the wealth management side is, you know, so we talked about the perspective triangle earlier. One of the things we try to do on that growth and income side is not play for a worst case scenario, but maintain the disciplines to manage risk in any environment and have exposures that do well in this kind of environment where you have inflation of asset prices and things continue to move up. On the other hand, you have to balance that out with things that are not necessarily tied to growth in either the domestic or international economy. So really important for us is managing risk on the downside and having a methodical way of doing that. And so, you know, working with Doug, working with Lila, working with Robert, our team is as cohesive as it's ever been in managing towards what Alfred is describing. What if this just goes on and on? Well, look, if you're playing for the Armageddon scenario and it goes on, you'll just be sitting there looking like an idiot.
This
right?
is where the triangle works, because you don't have to be right on either outcome.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So again, that's not high math, but it is a way of thinking, do I have my mandates balanced? Do I have something that is in play, growth and income? Do I have something that is in play, liquidity, in case something does come up that I want to buy? Talk to a friend today who's looking at a house not far from here. Beautiful home. I hope he uses some of his liquidity to take advantage of that. I think it'll be an amazing asset purchase for him. What about the insurance piece? That perspective triangle just helps you organize your mandates.
This next question is from Wesley, and I'm going to actually summarize it, Dave, because what he's talking about is using our monetary system as a form of warfare through SWIFT, through, you know, the dollar reserve system. Can you address that a little bit? I know you've got friends who are in the business of managing money and also in the form of warfare. I'm thinking in particular that gentleman that is with the U.S. Treasury that lived in Saudi Arabia, I think, for 8 years that you got to know.
Yeah. And he got his job there with the Treasury from Juan Zarate, who wrote the book Treasury's War. So they know each other well. And Juan basically posits in his book that the Treasury is a complement to our system of international governance. And we get to pull levers and push for more influence and control through things like SWIFT and the flow or limitation of the flow of capital. And so SWIFT is one of those things that is sort of foundational to our presence in the world. And obviously, if you look at the rest of the world looking for alternatives to SWIFT, it's because they don't like the amount of control we have in our relationships with them. So there's another point to Wesley's question, which is dealing with foreign currencies and specifically debt that is issued in foreign currency terms. And I think he borrows some from Jim Rickard's book, Currency Wars, and some ideas there. I think one of the reasons why you have so many people issuing debt in U.S. dollar terms is because it allows them to attract a larger audience of lenders. So the borrower is saying, I'm going to pay you back, and I believe myself to be a good bet. And the lender looks and says, maybe you are, maybe you aren't a good bet. I'm going to take a double bet if it's on the one hand, your reliability making payments, but also the reliability of your domestic currency. Why don't you put those things in U.S. dollar terms and eliminates one of the risk variables for me? So you're able to raise more money in the capital markets in U.S. dollar terms than you would be just in foreign currency terms, because there's, again, for the lender, there's one less risk variable there. So think about the motivations of the borrower, think about the motivations of the lender, think about the need for more debt financing. And I think that actually goes a long way towards why people finance their cross-border debt in foreign currency, in U.S. dollar terms versus foreign currency terms.
This is from a longtime listener in the Pacific Northwest. Now, this is, Dave, I'm just going to preface this by saying this is always a hot potato or a cold potato. All right. It just depends on what side of the issue you're on. But okay, so starting with the question, not sure if you're familiar with ADAPT 2030 podcast, but they've been rapping about the possibility of global cooling as a result of cycles of the sun reaching a grand solar minimum. These cyclical patterns are said to coincide with increased cloud cover, volcanism due to increased cosmic rays from a weakening magnetosphere. If true, we could be seeing successive crop losses leading to food price increases globally and increased tension in the next few years. It seems plausible to me, and my question is, how plausible is it to you guys? Regardless of whether we're heading into global warming or cooling, climate change is real, and the risks to food supplies never seem to get any press in the mainstream media. This could be a major geopolitical driver of world events heading forward. Would love to hear a show on this critical issue with an expert or two. Sincerely, thanks, longtime listener, Pacific Northwest.
Oh, well, now I'm getting close to the edge of what I don't know. And I thought you were going to say hot potato, cold potato, and then launch on something for velocity of money, because that I'd be very comfortable with.
I don't usually come to you for environmental questions, Dave, but maybe I could.
Let me start with something general, and then maybe you can add something more specific. The general comment is, regardless of how you view climate change, I think it's very important to look at the honesty and the goodness of politicians. And I suspect that when you're whipping the public into a frenzy on any particular issue, doesn't matter what the point of panic is, the sponsors of that panic generally serve to benefit from the prescription that they offer.
Ulterior motives.
Diagnosis, 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 prescription. And so if they can create consensus on what the issues are and then what the solutions are, and they happen to hold the solutions, then again, I'm more suspicious of the goodness of political machinations, of political policymaking, of the justification for more experts. And this really does go back to the conversation we had with Paul Tucker, where Paul would say, not only do monetary policy mandarins have nothing to do with climate change, they should stay out of it. It has nothing to do with their mandate. They cannot move the needle on that. To pretend that they can is to misunderstand what monetary policy is. But I think the larger point of his book is that we have experts who are unelected and they make rules and regulations. And I am just really not plus, I'm not enthusiastic about the idea of creating new branches of government with open, unended mandates based on the current fear, which is in the marketplace. And it's a global frenzy on climate change, to the point where I think if you said there was something called a climate messiah, that we would all fall at his feet and worship him, because he would have the answer to this problem, which is our sure death and destruction.
Well, and sometimes you can find out the truth of an issue when you look at what the pushback is. And if you're someone who actually challenges some of the science of global warming, that type of thing, you can't get published in the academic world. So there definitely is an agenda, whether there is climate change or not.
Yeah, but neither one of us have said actually anything positive or negative on the issue of climate change.
Right. Hot potato, cold potato.
Why don't you hold it?
Well, why don't we talk about sunspots for a second?
Okay.
Because this is something that we're going to hear in the news. And
actually is not related to the current issue of climate change, although there's confusing connection.
Right. And it could be, it might not be, but there's something called the Mondar minimum that occurred back in the 1600s when Galileo first started looking at sunspots, when he first started looking at the sun with a telescope. Now, that ultimately blinded him. Okay.
Whoops.
That was a problem. But he was a fascinating guy because he also was studying the moons of Jupiter and the movement there. And then he started to go blind as he was counting sunspots with a telescope. But here's the thing. In the 1600s, the sunspot activity went to a very, very low minimum.
That's the grand solar minimum you're talking about.
Yeah, that's right.
And a period of coolness.
But they don't know that they went together. And just like the author of this question says, volcanoes also could have caused this coolness in Europe. It was about a 60-year period of coolness. So again, we're going back to correlation versus cause.
And you're saying that actually the cooling predated the issue of grand solar minimum. That was already in place. So you'd have to go back to the 1500s and say, actually, we were in motion already on this prior to the grand solar minimum. But causation. association, correlation, and the confusion therein is what's a part of this to say now that, oh, well, because of the weakening magnetosphere.
Yeah. But bring a politician in and they'll go, oh, you know what? I can help you with sunspots. We all need to help with sunspots. And somehow, some way, agendas get moved and some people get rich and some people get poor. And it's like, what just happened? Because it really didn't change the sun at all.
Yeah, the nature of politics is about how to move as much money as possible to your constituents. And some of your constituents may be your friends. And so this is where, again, I'm suspicious about, give me a reason, give me a justification. And if you can really tap primal fear in any way, then I have a blank check. And what politician have you ever met that hasn't had a blank check? We're coming into a phase where it really is going to be a everyone's writing blank checks to solve climate change. And that's like a political paradise.
Well, and Paul Tucker even talked about, he sort of chuckled when we were talking about the new European Central Bank's mandate to help with climate change.
Well, at least that's what Christine Lagarde has signed herself on for. But I think in fairness to that longtime listener in the Pacific Northwest, we should have a commentary guest who can better lay out what are the issues in play with climate change. And if we just say, for the sake of argument, that we have a significant shift in, you know, constrained food productivity or whatever. Yes, you've got political tensions in China. You've got geopolitical issues. So you are right. You are right. If there is a continuation of trend where we have crop losses for any particular reason, yes, you're moving into a period of global crisis, which is also a period of extreme probability for war and conflict.
Well, and your family's always been oriented towards some form of preparation, letting everyone know, look, be prepared if things do change. Don't be so dependent on any one system that could be vulnerable. Question from Rick in San Diego. Hi, Dave. From time to time on the weekly commentary, you mention books that you consider must reads. If you wouldn't mind, I'd love to see a list of some of your favorites, but even more so, I'd be interested in what you might recommend as must reads for kids around ages 8 to 10. Thanks. I enjoy the weekly discussion.
Rick, in a world of continual website updates, I used to have a list of books in the resources section on our precious metals brokerage website, McIlvanyICA.com. It may still be there. Honestly, I don't know. If not, we can get that up and published for you. But to your second point, must reads for kids ages 8 to 10. You know, we have a spectrum of a readership in our family from very strong readers to really not interested as much. So an 8 to 10 year old is not only a wide enough spectrum in age and ability, but even natural ability within that.
You do have a 13-year-old though that you can't tear a book out of his hands.
No, it's true. We went to the Nutcracker the other night and it's so funny. I looked over and he's reading a book and he looked over and
yeah. And his sister's
dancing.
To my
wife's chagrin, right. I was reading a book too. My wife got after me, not him. I had to put mine away. But to the point, to the question, there's a couple of things. I think I'd categorize books according to kind of where you want impact. If it's, you know, how do you understand economics? For a young reader, something like Whatever Happened to Penny Candy? It's just a great...
That's Richard Mayberry, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a great conversation starter. If you're talking about gaining a language of communicating an interior life, there's a book that I read with our kids a while back called The Bridges of Chara. Hmm. And it's an allegory, and it begins to flush out some of the language that you need to know to be able to appreciate your inner landscape and to be able to talk about it. Frankly, it would be good for a 28-year-old or a 58-year-old or a 98-year-old to read.
I better read it. I've never heard of it.
But it's one of those things, you know, categorize that as sort of emotional development. You know, probably a little bit more advanced, but I think it opens up really interesting conversations about sort of who you live for. Is it just for yourself or for others? Bob Goff wrote a book called Everybody Always, and its focus is really just on how other-centeredness is a powerful thing in the world that we live in and getting outside of yourself. He's a lawyer and a really good one. And, you know, that might be more of a 10, 12-year-old book. Let me get to a couple of other ones. The Dangerous Journey, which was edited by Oliver Hunken. The Dangerous Journey is, I think, a great one. History Lives, which is a 5-volume set put together by Mindy and Brandon Withrow. And then I'll just give you a couple more, which I think were great. You probably know The Secret Garden. It's been made into plays and whatnot. There's two other ones by the same author, Little Lord Fauntleroy. And the other one is A Little Princess. And there's so many sort of character principles, and you see transformation occur from, you know, sort of the selfish little brat to someone who appreciates the other, or is able to bring in a higher ethic to how they live their life. And again, The Secret Garden, Little Lord Fauntleroy, A Little Princess, all of those are great. Same kind of transformational story in terms of maturing, starting at one place and growing up a little bit, is The Miraculous Journey of Edward Tulane. And so those are kind of kids' books that jump off the shelf at me in that 8 to 10 year old range, maybe for a strong reader. But if not a strong reader, something that could be read out loud. And that plays very well.
I think what we have to do, though, Dave, is go back, because I haven't looked in a long time either. We should check if that book list is there, because we've added books as we've had authors on the show as well. Because you'll read a book, you'll go pursue the author, and then we'll recommend the book, not necessarily because the author's on, but because you start to realize it's part of the content and the context of the thinking of the show.
And I think one of the things to keep in mind, and this is just kind of a general principle of not only what goes into a library, but also what you read and when and why you read it. Somebody may recommend a book to you, and it could just be awful. You pick it up and you're like, this is just not hitting anything. No hot buttons here.
20 years later?
20 years later, yeah. It changes your life. And it's not that the book was bad. It's that the timing was off.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think it's important to read where you're curious. It's important to dive in where you have a passion. And you can destroy a child's interest in learning and in books if you go through a random list and just say, well, these are the classics. You have to read them.
Well, and give books with no obligation. See, that I had to learn that because my feelings would get hurt, or I would hurt other people's feelings. But give a book with no obligation. Let them know you won't ask if it's been read. And then a lot of times people will come back many years later and say, the timing was right. I read that book. Thank you.
Right. So that's really what the exploration is as a parent, is figuring out where there is the current question. What's the current curiosity? And how do you attach the right book to that? Because now you've got natural energy driving the pursuit, getting through those pages. I mean, it's so fascinating. I put some carrot juice on the table this morning, and everybody was pretty excited about it. And then I said, I also added celery and ginger, and everybody had been reaching for the glass. And all I had to say was celery, and everybody pulled their hand back like, ugh, right? So, you got to tap enthusiasm, right? And there was enthusiasm and then a buzzkill. And, you know, the idea that someone is enthusiastic and reaching for it, that's what you want with books. But you really got to be sensitive to the kinds of questions and the point of curiosity that people have.
This next question comes from Timothy. He says, Dear David, I have two questions. Birth rate in almost all developed and most developing countries is already below replacement level. It seems that this trend is almost irreversible. How do you see the impact of declining populations on economies, societies, and cultures? That's the first question. Do you want me to wait on that?
Let me answer that one first, because I think it's Japan and China as kind of a preview of coming attractions. Anyone who has that issue of, you know, being below the replacement level, you know, you've got issues of fiscal strain. And, you know, when you start looking at the commitments that have been made, we're talking welfare commitments or social safety net commitments, you end up with math problems. You end up with math problems on the basis of that demography. And it means that future tax structure, incentives within the market economies, if you're in a market economy, those things can shift.
Well, you brought up in Japan, I think you brought this up on a commentary not long ago, that more diapers are being sold to geriatrics in Japan than there are babies using the diapers.
Right. So fast forward, and you've got more people taking out of the system. You know, they put in, and they thought that the money was going to be held for them and given back to them with growth.
Right.
As it turned out, most of those social safety nets are just an excuse for higher taxation. And there is no sort of slush fund that or a safety fund that's actually there. So, you know, you've been financing the present day. Nobody was considering your future. That's really the issue, because the math begins to emerge. You have to have a certain number of workers to take care of a certain number of retirees.
So the social security systems of those countries, maybe even including our own, would be at risk if you don't have replacement.
Right. And I think what time reveals and demography reveals is where the social safety nets have been run fraudulently. Social Security has been run fraudulently. The Senate has robbed those funds. There are a few dollars there, but nothing like was supposed to be there because they broke the penny bank and stole the money.
Okay. So the second part of the question, the first part was about people. The second part is about machines. He says, do you agree with Eric Brynjolfsson and Andrew McAfee, the authors of The Second Machine Age, that this time may be different for technological impact on economies and societies? I haven't read the book. Have you read the book?
I have started the book and invited Eric onto the program. So I'm great that you're reading it. Timothy, we're definitely on the same page in terms of some of our interests. The technological impact on economies and societies, again, I think you're talking about why we're having conversations in public policy circles about universal basic income. You know, there comes a point at which the whole fabric of society shifts. The way we look at work and employment shifts. The way we look at income and how it's derived shifts. And, you know, there are blessings and curses with an improvement in technology. And I think some of the curses aren't just at the level of, you know, loss of jobs or things that may be a little bit more obvious, but it's loss of identity. It's the social and psychological impacts of a broken workforce or a newly constructed workforce. And then the argument's being made now that, look, as it has in past times, the technology is freeing us to do more of what we want. And I think we forget that we are who we are in part by what we do and our place in the world, the contribution we make, whether that is as a teacher or as a doctor. I think there is a certain banality to free time and a certain boredom. I think of all the famous people who have gained all the money in the world and at some point have all the time in the world, and their lives veer towards drug addictions and unhealthy relationships. And it's not like free time makes a free person or free time makes for a better person. And so I do see sort of a downside in terms of a societal impact. And I, this isn't me being sort of, you know, what do they call the people who don't like technology? Luddites. I am not a Luddite, and I appreciate technology, but there are some unintended consequences in terms of personal identity and psychology, which I think we should be considering as we move sort of fast and furious towards a world changed utterly and maybe forever by technology.
Good evening, David and Kevin. I've been a listener of the commentary for several years now, and I understand about half of the content. Well, that's better than me, Kelly, so you're doing well.
We'll work on clear communication. The fault is ours.
But it still remains one of my must-listen podcasts every week. Personal context. I'm married with one child now in college, a house with a mortgage, one car payment. I'm employed full-time with a very good income for middle class in my part of the country. We're saving for retirement with a combination of traditional IRAs and my 401k. We are setting aside some money in bank savings and vaulted, which I really like, by the way. Here's the question. Is there something I should be doing or avoiding in light of the growing credit bubble in the next months and years as it pertains to my position in the middle class? I really enjoy your podcast. Keep up the good work. Thanks, Kelly.
You know, I think one of the challenges faced by many in the middle class is this idea that you mark your progress by the things that you have, the clothes that you wear, the house that you live in, the cars that you drive. And that's where we get that sort of keeping up with the Joneses. So not to just fixate on, you know, socioeconomic status in the context of this question, but I do think, you know, bringing that into what is a general tendency of the middle class into where we're at in terms of a credit bubble, you've got to a couple of practical things: avoid buying depreciating assets. You know, and this may
sound simple.
Sounds simple, but you know, there can be sort of, let's call it the middle class malaise, where maybe you don't love your job and that's why you live for the weekends and that's why you justify the boat, the four wheeler, the this, the that, and the other. And they're all depreciating assets, and it costs real money in terms of earnings, savings, and everything else. But the day you buy it, it's worth a third less the year after you've driven it around, it's worth half less. And it's just no way to sort of advance where you're at or to position yourself advantageously in the context of a major credit bubble. I think this applies regardless of socioeconomic status. Avoid conspicuous consumption. You know, this is, we're moving into a period of time where those marks of distinction, whether it's, you know, the blue box from Tiffany's, the red box from Cartier, or the insignia on the front of your car, BMW, Mercedes, whatever it may be, it shows well from a sociocultural standpoint. But I think in the context, in the months and years ahead, in terms of a growing credit bubble, as that unwinds, I think you begin to see tendencies towards envy, tendencies towards redistributionism. As we consider the 2020 political field or the 2024 political field, think about who fills the Democratic primary today. Half of them have said, we are socialists. Democrats, that party tagline, it doesn't even fit. They would say that their real belief system is more in line with a socialist platform. Maybe they should run as socialists instead of Democrats. All that to say, do you really want to stand out from the crowd? I'm not sure that in the next 3, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years, that's a wise thing to be doing. So those are just some practical considerations. What you're doing now, Kelly, I think makes a lot of sense. You are living beneath your means. Otherwise, you can't have the extra money to put into bank savings or vaulted. You wouldn't be putting into your traditional IRA or 401k. So you're doing what you need to do. And in addition, you know, having a game plan for reducing your debt, I think is absolutely wise. You've got a mortgage, one car payment, great. Make sure that you're not using your credit cards as anything other than a monthly float, paying them off at the end of every month, but also making sure that you've kind of penciled out, whether it's on an Excel spreadsheet or with a date, sort of your date with destiny. When are you paying off the mortgage and car payment? Those are things that represent emotional space as much as they do financial freedom.
This next question comes from Marty, and I can hear the fatigue in Marty's voice. Okay. When do you think that the manipulation of precious metals by the bullion banks and the Fed will fail and we have a free market again? Marty, I can hear your frustration.
Well, let me take a little bit of umbrage with the question. It's a good question,
right?
Because there are manipulative tendencies in the markets today, but I'd say it's far more dramatic in the world of interest rates and fixed income,
right,
than in the area of gold. I mean, we've got gold up 15% this year, silver up 10%. And, you know, at an earlier part of the year, we were up 20% and 15% respectively. Right. You know, mining shares are up between 30 and 40% this year. So you're talking about something that is operating on a somewhat free basis.
Quasi-free market versus interest rates.
Right. I think that the question there, the implicit is, why isn't gold at 5,000 already? Why isn't gold at 10,000 already? That's what I would read into the question, because there really can't be any frustration with the way that gold has behaved in the current period. 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019, these are free market dynamics driving the price up from then to now by 50%.
Well, and can I say, Dave, I mean, I've been here 32 years, and back in the 80s, we talked about gold manipulation. And then in the 90s, we talked about gold manipulation. And then in the 2000s, we talked about gold manipulation. In the 2010s, and now we're coming into 2020. And during that period of time, gold, yes, it was manipulated, but it was at $300 an ounce when I got here. Then it went to 600, then it went to 900, then it went to 1200. Now it's at 14 something. Yeah, they manipulate, but it doesn't really change the trend.
Well, but in fairness, there's a difference between short-term manipulation and long-term manipulation, where I think, you know, you can level any market for a certain period of time, but not permanently.
Yeah.
So if you want to pick a fight and jab somebody in the nose, that's great. But is there anybody with the financial or monetary endurance to go round after round after round, decade after decade after decade? Because that's what suppression
would
be.
And it doesn't affect you if you buy and just hold. It does not affect you unless you're trading to try to make money.
When you started in the business in the 1980s, there were periods of time where the Saudis would come in and bear raid the crud out of the market and knock the price goal down by 10%.
So that they could buy more at a cheaper price.
Right. So there's, you know, is that manipulation? Sure. Yeah. Is it for a particular party's benefit?
Do the Absolutely. Chinese maybe do it now? Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, but whether it's the Chinese or Goldman Sachs, I mean, JP Morgan, I guess, would be they'd have the big, you know, we are the manipulators written all over them. Right. But the point is, we do see free market dynamics in the gold space. Mm-hmm. And certainly we do see price manipulation. You've seen in 2019 and in 2018, a number of people, whether it's HSBC or Barclays or JP Morgan, people who were previously trading with them, they're being prosecuted for manipulation of price. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. My eyes aren't closed, but we're also not talking about a grand suppression scheme that has kept gold in the 250-300 range. Because bear in mind, over the last 20 years, if you're going back to that period of time, we still have gold
outperforming the stock market
over this 20-year period.
Yeah.
So everyone's saying, well, stocks are at all-time highs. Gold's not. Bear in mind, even not being at all-time highs, we've still averaged over a 20-year period almost an 8% annual return. Now, obviously, averages don't matter to everybody because, you know, maybe you only care about the last 2 years or 3 years or whatever. But, you know, that 20-year period, it still shows positive gains in traction. Where I think we have the greater and more important manipulation is the manipulation of signaling within the stock and bond markets, and it's done particularly in the bond market. You control the cost of capital. If you can control the cost of capital, you increase the speculative tendencies within the market. People take more risk. You take away the sort of the governor, so to say, and allow people to do things they wouldn't ordinarily do. If you had to make a bet, but you were paying 10% as you go or paying 5% as you go, you know, that bet is going to be far more calculated than you got free money. What are you going to do with it? Well, we're just going to bet on just about anything. So there's more risk in the market because of the manipulation of interest rates. And you can see that in bond yields. What's fascinating to me, and this is worth noting, I don't think we have any questions on this, so I'll just mention it here. We have seen an increase in interest rates over the last 3 to 6 months. And I don't know if we've actually put in the lows here in 2019, but all of those negative rates and the tens of trillions of dollars that were negatively yielding, those rates are starting to come up.
Hmm. Ooh, is that the free market bearing its little head?
Yeah, what kind of endurance do you have to continue to buy and buy and buy and suppress and suppress and suppress? When you stop manipulating a market, then you have sort of the revelation for real supply and real demand. And I think we're beginning to see that to some degree in the European bond markets. And that actually ties into the gold story, because it's not that the bullion markets have been directly manipulated to the detriment of price. I mean, again, if you want to talk about a $5 manipulation, a $20 manipulation, what have you, fine. But the greater manipulation is the manipulation of the mass mind, which sees no reason to own gold because we live in a perfect world and we're dealing with the perfect set of monetary mandarins who are controlling outcomes in a positive way. There's no downside here. And so if you can convince people that there's no downside here, then there's also no reason to have that insurance component within a portfolio mandate. It's a waste of money. People today would look at gold and say, why would I allocate to gold when there's only upside in the market? You, my friend, if that is your mindset, you have been manipulated. You are controlled and your actions are contributing to the distortion in asset prices, where gold may be lower than it could have been or ultimately will be, and stocks are higher than they can stay forever.
This next question is from Nathan. I'm an investor that's building my cash and metals position with the goal of being able to take a nice position in stocks the next time they, quote, go on sale. When that day comes, I wouldn't mind buying individual stocks, but I've learned that you have to know how to read balance sheets, cash flow statements, etc., to make sure you're not buying a lemon. Your MAPS products, McIlvany Wealth Management products, sound appealing, but last I checked, I don't have enough assets to qualify. How would you recommend a small-time investor go about taking a position in stocks? Why don't you start there, Dave?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of years before you really need to be considering a major move into equities. We haven't seen any decline in equities. And so, you know, it takes some time for a bear market to wear on. And so keep this in mind. The first drop in a major market is not necessarily the place that you want to buy. You can go through long periods of time where there's low rates of return or no reason for those shares to recover. So even if you bought them at an absolute low, it still wasn't quite time to buy.
Can I tag on the last part of the question then? Because he's asking then when that time comes, if an ETF is appropriate. I could read the question, but that's really what he's asking. ETFs are sort of a quasi-hybrid kind of an investment. What do you think, Dave?
Well, let me say this. I think in terms of our MAPS strategies, it's an acronym that stands for multiplier, accumulator, protector, and strategic. And, you know, those are portfolio styles and strategies which give a broad diversification to individual companies, not ETFs and not third-party asset managers or whatever. So there is a limitation in terms of how much money it takes to effectively diversify a portfolio into individual asset allocations. So I would say this, on the time horizon, Nathan, that you have and that I think is appropriate, our intention is to have mutual funds which represent the MAPS strategies, where you could participate with $1,000, with $5,000, with $50,000, whatever the amount would be, and benefit from that diversification, but not with the current limitations that we have in terms of account size. So product development is something that we certainly have in mind as we are going forward to meet the needs of every investor, as we've done with Vaulted. I mean, look, Vaulted, if you get $10 and you want to do sort of savings in gold and use that as an alternative bank account, we are not the kind of people who say, oh, well, we only take $1 million account. No, I mean, I think we want to design the best quality products for everyone. And Vaulted is reliable savings for everyone.
Yeah, MAPS there's like will a $10 minimum on Vaulted, I think.
Right. And MAPS ultimately will be reliable hard asset investing for everyone.
This is a question from Warren. Hi, team. A recent conversation I heard with Art Berman and Chris Martinson, which, by the way, was a guest of ours in the past, brought up some very intriguing points regarding energy and our predicament. My question is under these points. One, solar isn't keeping up with yearly increases in demand for energy, so we're not really well off on our way to meaningful transitions away from fossil fuels. Two, humans are painfully slow to change and have a lot of faith in technology to solve their problems. Three, tight oil is the best of a bad bunch, most economically viable, but oil is generally a losing proposition. And this one blew me away. Four, renewables are a lower density energy source and don't allow us to continue our system the way it is now. Long-term storage of energy remains a major problem, and it's essential to learn to live with less moving forward. Here's the question. Would you agree that it would be wise to learn to live with less, given what we seem headed for in the long term with systemic energy crunches in general? Art and Chris seem to see us headed for much higher energy prices across the board. Thank you for your show.
Yeah, there's some really good things that we could talk about here. I think I'd start with the big picture. I will start with sort of macro and then move to micro. At the macro level, so if you have an energy issue, present tense or on the horizon, and there's no way to solve it at the macro level, that does not preclude there being small things that you as an individual can do. So when I looked at writing the book on legacy, one of the things that I was pointing out is you've got big picture issues, and there are little things that you can do as an individual, owning your decisions, which impact your little, call it microclimate, your family, your community, your state. And I'm not sure if they ultimately serve the macro issues, but I know that when we look at macro issues, whether it's, you know, fiscal, you know, our debt levels over $23 trillion, we got there $1 at a time, right? So it was micro, and now we've got an aggregate, a macro issue, and there's no way to solve the macro at the macro. At least they haven't proposed a policy that would help us with that in a healthy way yet. So my version, and why I tend to sort of shrink back to what are your personal choices as a means of empowering you through perhaps a difficult challenge or a challenging environment, it's going to be a different conversation. And I think this is very consistent with what Chris has talked about. Don't know Art Berman's conversation that they had particularly, but I know Chris, and we've talked before, as well as Adam, his colleague. So what do I have in mind in particular? Well, so let's look at the increase in fossil fuels and the impact that has for the system that we have as a whole. One of my best friends has solar on their house. And it's a decision that they made. As Chris said, and as you mentioned in your question, the renewables are a lower density energy source. Okay, so maybe solar is not a solution at the macro level. But I can tell you that in 3 years, they haven't had an energy bill.
Right.
And it doesn't matter what the cost of energy is for the next 10 to 15 years for them.
My mom gets a check back every month.
Well, and that's the point. So I'm going to circle all the way back to one of the earliest questions we had last week, which was, you know, we were talking about taxes and we were talking about moving from traditional IRAs to Roth IRAs. We oftentimes think about what we make, and sometimes it's more important to think about what we keep. Right. So taxes are a big issue. This energy issue and focusing on life that is more simple and ways of living that are more sustainable and doing something like that. If you had solar on your house, my dad had solar on their house when they lived here in Colorado for 20 years. And, you know, when the lights went out, they were the only one in the valley with the lights on. But like your mom, there's this paycheck coming in because they're producing more energy than they need.
Right.
Which means that, you know, again, maybe that doesn't solve the macro level issues, but it does solve your issues and it does insulate you from rising costs. So what you make and what you keep, I'd say for anyone living on a fixed income, these are the kinds of things, these are problems you want to solve, because if you have a fixed income or 20 years from now, you plan on retiring and you're going to be on a fixed income or arbitrarily set yourself on one because of what the income is you can generate from your assets, how do you cap costs? These are practical ways that you can do that, right?
You know, and Dave, something we both have faced forest fires in this area and the possibility of having to evacuate at times. And something that really struck me, and I don't know if this applies or not, but, you know, you think there's just a ton of things you're going to put in your car if your house may burn down. And we actually had room left over. We said, let's just take the essentials. We had been told to evacuate. And, you know, we got the stuff in the car and we realized there's very little we really need. And I was amazed. I was amazed. It was a great lesson at that time. So that you can simplify.
Yep. An amazing exercise. We went through the same thing only about 3 years ago. Lightner Creek fires were raging.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were given a pre-evac, not an evacuation notice, but pre-evac. And we just sat down with the kids and we said, look, we don't know what happens here, but, the things that you can't replace.
Yeah.
You know, for my 3-year-old at the time, you know, he couldn't imagine losing his Beanie Boos, but
I'm sure the Legos came too. I know your kids,
but here's the reality. Yeah. We can replace those.
Right.
So actually they didn't make it in the duffel bag.
Okay.
There was a reality that set in and they're like, oh, well, we can replace all that stuff.
Right.
So 6 people we stuffed into a small duffel bag, and not the actual people, but their stuff.
That didn't sound right, Dave. Leave that in the recording.
No,
for sure.
It was not the body. You know. So I guess I look at the question from Warren in 2 different ways. One, you can look at fossil fuels, you can look at energy from the standpoint of an investor. Okay, so higher prices, what do higher prices mean? Higher energy costs means that those companies attached to them have greater resources to innovate, to find alternatives, to invest in new technology, to open up less feasible resources, you know, where all of a sudden, if oil is at $150 a barrel, there are resources that you can tap that were not feasible until it was above 100, right? But are now profitable and never were considered a part of a basis of resources. So from an investment thesis, you can look at it from that standpoint. Then as an individual dealing with the consequences of higher prices, which ultimately puts pressure on your personal sustainability, you can answer that question in a different way. And I think there are some practical things that you
can
do.
And you should.
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of times people with good heart, they go out and buy the wrong investment at the wrong time, thinking that this is the new trend. And it may not be, but 10 years from now, you know, or more before that actually takes form. This is where Lila Murphy, I love listening to Lila Murphy because she's looking that direction, you know, in her management of the investment, but she's also saying not yet.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, for Art and Chris's comments, you know, if we're seeming to be headed towards higher energy prices across the board, there's an investment thesis to develop out of that. There's also a personal insulation thesis, which should be developed out of that.
Dave, this question is from Jake. Kevin and David, I've been listening to you guys for years now, and I finally am at a place where I've been unable to answer my own question. The question pertains to the term value with a capital V that we humans use. There are a great many applications of use one can apply to it: subjective, objective, intrinsic, extrinsic, use, theoretical, personal, etc., etc. The issue I have with it, in not being able to define value in an all-encompassing way, what is its final meaning?
Right. Now, let me just be clear here. Jake, you sent us an excellent question, which spans four pages. We just edited it down to...
three sentences, I think. Four,
correct.
Maybe.
So what I would do is, Jake, I would invite you out to Durango and we'll sit and have a glass of Talisker and have the conversation that does justice to...
I know you enjoyed reading the whole question and you did a lot of research.
I did, and I would also enjoy the Talisker with Jake. So, yeah. Jake, anytime you're passing through Durango, plan on that conversation. I think, you know, when you're looking at the difficulty of defining it, whether it's the real tangible intrinsic value, extrinsic value, subjective, objective, personal, there are different approaches to it. I think what you're up against is the word fits into a lot of different categories and can be used differently. So there's economic value, there's social value, there's mathematic value, there's philosophical value. So, and there's varieties of ways to define value or use that term within each of those fields.
Isn't
it takes
this
on
a
different
meaning?
Nuance.
Isn't this a meaning of life question? This may be the question, Dave, right here.
Yeah. And I mean, even if you wanted to flip to the Oxford English Dictionary, it's not something that is defined in one simple way. It's 2.5 pages. It's 15 different definitions. And then you look at how it's been used differently.
By the way, Jake, he's got his big Oxford English Dictionary open right now as he's answering the question. I mean, this is one of how many volumes that you have. I mean,
and this is the point, is that there's 65,000 words in the English language we typically don't use, but say 3,000 to 5,000. Value is one that has at least 15 definitions. And when I see 15 definitions to a word, I think to myself, even with 65,000 words to get very specific on meaning, we can't get specific enough. So I'm not sure that there is an answer to your question, Jake. And a part of this, I mean, if we flipped to German, we could take a word and add a prefix and a suffix to it and get closer to a concise and precise meaning. That's the beauty of German, is that you can get more out of the language. Mm-hmm. With 65,000 words to choose, at 15 definitions on this words, it means there's actually not enough words for us to get to the heart of that meaning.
But it is the right question. In other words, that shouldn't discourage the question for every listener. What is value in your life?
No, and I mean, we are talking about a variety of different things when we talk about gold having intrinsic value, or you want to argue that point and say, no, it's on the basis of social consensus that we haven't. Because even that point is debatable when you say to yourself, yes, we've come to consensus after 5,000 years that gold has, silver has, platinum, palladium have intrinsic value.
Right.
Okay, but let's change the context. If we change the context and all of a sudden, you know, I can't get food for my family, I care more about my neighbor's chicken and trading that than I do gold. And he may not care at all about my gold. It may have zero value in that context because something has, well, greater.
Well, and you remember Adam Ferguson's book, you brought it up. A grand piano was traded for a chicken, okay? Yep. Because value changes then, doesn't it, by need?
I know, and this probably, I know there's personality types that will be driven crazy by this question and also kind of our exploration, because it's not exactly an answer, but it's more of an exploration and conversation.
Well, remember, we're talking to a philosophy major too, okay? I always think that when you start defining something like value.
And you can define value, and the Oxford English Dictionary has 15 different ways.
There you go.
So I guess we get back to the most important part, which is, Jake, when are you coming through town for a Talisker?
Yeah. And you would value that. And, you know, just to say thank you very much to our listeners, because speaking of value, I don't think our listeners fully understand just how much we value the fact that they take the time every week, Dave, to listen to this commentary. Time of, we've talked before, there are many things that we all have different multiples of, but we all have about the same amount of time, the same amount of heartbeats. I think I heard one time it's 2 billion for most animals, whether it's a bee or whether it's us, it's about 2 billion heartbeats. Now, I may be wrong on that, but we all have about that amount of time. And we have listeners who've listened for 11 years. Talk about value.
We appreciate that. And we hope that the conversation continues to bring insight, wisdom, affirmation, confirmation, bring something of value to you. We appreciate you very much.
And that wraps it up for our New Year's Day program. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.